Well, we're going to begin our course on the history of Western philosophy, looking at ancient and medieval philosophy in this particular course, and then later we'll be dealing with modern and recent philosophy. Now, as we get underway this morning, let's have a word of prayer. We do come into your holy presence, our Father, and ask that you would receive us for the sake of Christ, our Savior, and through his mediation. We do not come claiming any sufficiency of our own or any accomplishment or any right to stand before you. Our sufficiency is completely by your grace. Our right to stand before you is only through your Son, Jesus Christ. We do ask for your forgiveness for the sake of Christ and his sacrifice. We do pray that you would see his righteousness as our own. We do pray that you would hear us because he intercedes on our behalf. We ask for enlightenment of your spirit, that we might please you, we might think your thoughts after you. We do pray that through this course we would learn to know you better and to know your world better and to know ourselves better. We pray that you would enable us to study these things always with the mind on what you have taught, that we might compare the thinking of the world to the thinking of your holy word, to the truth that is found therein. We pray that you would equip us to defend the Christian faith better because we have studied these matters. We ask in all things that you would receive the glory and that we would look for you, for we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, we're going to study the Western approach to philosophy. Just real quickly, let's make clear that there is an Eastern approach to philosophy as well. We could be teaching a course on the history of Eastern philosophy. It's just that it would look much different and it wouldn't have near the cultural relevance that the development of our own Western systems of thought would have for us. I have to say that because in our day and age, you know, there's this this campaign on to suggest that, you know, there's a Western kind of imperial attitude ideologically or culturally that says the only thing important that ever happened was in the Western world, you know, Northern Europe and, you know, the dead white male kind of syndrome, that's really what's important. And I don't have that perspective. I didn't need the liberals of our day to enlighten me about that. I know very well that the Chinese and the Korean and all sorts of other cultures developed along with Western thought. It so happens, though, that in God's providence, the development of the Christian church went first to the West. And it does not surprise me, therefore, that you also see in the West the reflection on the nature of man and his place in the universe, how he should live his life, how he knows the things that he knows. And again, since that is most relevant to us in our day and age, we're going to stick to the plan and study Western philosophy. The history of Western philosophy, that's the second thing I need to tell you about. You can study philosophy in two different ways. You can study the history of philosophy, as we will do in this course, or you can study the problems of philosophy. The difference being, of course, that by studying the problems of philosophy, you go to the questions, to the key issues, and you ask, what have people said about them? And what are the different schools of thought? What are the different options or answers for these problems? And I'll be honest with you, that is my preference. I don't know if it's just a personality thing or whether there is, in fact, more value for Christians to get to what are the basic issues. I like studying the problems of philosophy, or sometimes called systematic or topical philosophy. Our course, because of your place in college, however, is going to be more historically oriented. We're going to go and look at the different people who have been known as philosophers and look at the questions they addressed and the answers they gave. You'll end up covering the material either way. It's kind of like the way the weave goes, you know. One studies it this way and the other studies it this way, but the point, you're going to be covering the ground. Maybe we'll have another course on the problems of philosophy later, but for now, the history of Western philosophy. So we've studied, I mean, now you know why I'm calling it history and Western. But what about this last word, philosophy? That's the real important one. The history of Western philosophy. Before you can study the history of Western philosophy, you have to know what philosophy is. Won't do you any good to study the history of baseball if you don't know what baseball is. A wouldn't that be a great assignment for somebody? Go write 5 volumes on the history of baseball. The guy says, that's fine. What's a baseball? Or what is baseball? Or something like that. So it should be obvious, shouldn't it, that we don't know what we're studying, do we? And we don't have any idea of how to interpret and relate these things, and we don't have some concept of what philosophy is. And so you might want to stop and think for just a minute here. What do you think philosophy is? When we go to study philosophy, where should we begin? I mean, what is philosophy all about? What does philosophy study? I think it would help to understand what philosophy is if we took a few moments and reflected on how philosophy arises. And that means we have to take a few steps back and look at the nature of man and how we develop intellectually. In Genesis 1:26, we read in the Bible that God defined the nature and the task of man. God told our first parents, Adam in particular, that he was to have dominion over all of creation. He was to subdue the created order. And that is to say, he was to gain control over his environment. He had to learn what the world was like, what the animals were like. He was to understand the world in which he lived, and he was to use it for the glory of God. Man is at base an inquisitive animal or creature. Obviously, there are some people, unfortunately, born with brain damage and other situations that arise that it's not each and every individual that has an inquisitive nature, but naturally, without some kind of defect or other problem or obstacle arising, people come into this world as inquisitive. If Adam had not had a curiosity, he would not have been able to go out and learn about the created order and subdue it to God's glory. And we have that same basic human nature that God gave to Adam. We are inquisitive. Babies are inquisitive. If you've been around babies at all, you know that. You put a baby in a crib, and why do we have mobiles and colorful things? Because babies take an interest in that. They reach out for things. They come to recognize their mother's face and voice and so forth. And as children grow, we see their inquisitive or curious nature. An expression you all know, and it's something of a running joke, you hand something to a baby and it's going to go into his or her mouth. Okay, so they're finding out, they're trying to understand, quote-unquote, the world. They wouldn't call it that, but they're trying to understand their environment. What is this place in which I live, and how does it work? Children learn very early that knowledge is power, that the more they know, the better they can get the things they want. Now, sometimes it's very sinful. They know that mother is going to respond if they cry, so they learn to be very bratty, and they'll cry to get the things they want in some cases. Or they learn that jumping out of the crib head first is not the way to, you know, have a pleasant day, and so they'll stop doing that kind of thing. I'm being very simple here. My point is, our curiosity leads us to learn things about the world and to try to control our environment. The baby is, in a sense, controlling his environment when he learns not to hit his head on the floor, not to burn his hand on the stove, or not to call his big brother names that, you know, gets him smacked in return. Whatever it may be, knowledge is gained so that we can get along in this world better. We can get the things we want. So children are curious, and curiosity or inquisitiveness is grounded, I think, in the basic nature of man as God created him, to know this world, to subdue it, and to do so for his glory. Okay, so children grow, and they learn things. In fact, it's amazing how quickly children learn. They start catching on to things. They amass a great deal of information. But somewhere along the line in school and their educational process, curiosity takes us a step beyond learning what makes us happy, whether we like chocolate milk or orange juice, and you know how to get along on the playground and things of that nature. Curiosity leads us to ask about patterns that we find in the world, about recurring events or regularities that are observed. And so we start studying specific areas of the created order in a more disciplined way. We don't just take in any information about colors and what tastes good or feels good or what works well on the playground. We start organizing information into categories. The information we have about snails and birds and grass and so forth. And we know that that's different than the information we know about mom and dad and how to get along with brother. Okay? So we start getting some idea of life being divided into different areas. And as we look at these different areas, our curiosity makes us want to reduce all the particular things we've experienced or learned to more general laws. One of the first general laws, although it's not self-consciously seen as a law, one of the first general laws people learn would have to do with what we call gravity. You find out that if you drop the ball, it falls to the floor. But you also find out that if you push the book over the edge of the table, it falls to the floor. And also, if you drop your fork at dinner, it falls to the floor. And eventually, you'd have to be pretty dull, wouldn't you, to not catch on. There's a general pattern here. Things fall. Okay? We're not being real sophisticated, but children learn that things fall. And in school, they learn about gravity. They learn to look at the physical world and to generalize. There are certain patterns that are there, the pattern of things falling, which we call gravity. So when we start delineating an aspect of the world, it may be physical things and the feature of their falling, or it may be what we would call biological things or things mechanical, things social. When we start delineating an area of the world and asking about the general laws that help us explain what happens in that area of life, and then systematize those general laws, we are doing science. Now, please don't make the mistake that is so common in our day of hearing the word science and thinking of laboratories. Okay? When I use the word science, I mean it in the ancient and Latin sense of gaining knowledge. Science isn't just natural science. Science is the attempt to find systematic and general laws that help explain things or our experience in a delineated aspect of the world. Let me say that again. Science is the systematic attempt, or the attempt to find systematic and general laws about that will enable us to explain our experience in a delineated aspect of the world. So what I've explained thus far in terms of human cognitive development, very simply, is we have the level of curiosity. Okay, so make sure you have that in your notes. Curiosity is the first step. Curiosity eventually shades into what we'll call the level of scientific thinking. Scientific thinking is marked by three things. It's systematic, it uses general laws to explain, and it's about some delineated aspect of the world, astronomy or biology or sociology, or mechanical drawing, or whatever it may be, a delineated aspect of the world. Now, a lot of people are thinking, that's as far as it has to go. I mean, human cognitive development is just fine. We have the curiosity of childhood, and we have the more scientific, educated approach of our more mature years, and science is just fine, as it is. But you know what? man's curiosity pushes him beyond that, and not in some vain and speculative way. I don't want you to think that philosophy starts with somebody having too much time on his hands, and so they sit around saying, why is there air? You know, that's kind of like the comedian's version of philosophy. And I laugh at the jokes like that, too. Our philosophers have their own foibles and everything. But that has nothing to do with where philosophy comes from and why people philosophize. When we start thinking about the world and we try to be systematic and have general laws that will help us explain things, well, questions arise. And I'm going to give you three kinds of questions in particular that arise. First of all, we have questions about the extent of our scientific thinking. The extent of our scientific thinking. That is to say, is what we know from the study of the world, trying to systematically and generally have laws that explain our experience, is what we know, thinking scientifically, all there is to know? Is this the whole game right here? Is there more to it than what man himself can come up with? That is a question about science, and it's not a question that science itself can answer. Now, that's not a scientific question. That's not about some delineated aspect of life where you have some general laws of explanation. There are no general laws that help us answer the nature of science and the extent of science. Can science tell us everything? Maybe yes, maybe no. But even beyond that, even if you think science could tell us everything, I don't. But even if it could, you would still have questions about the nature of science. What are we doing when we study the world? What is the relationship between the person doing the study and that which he is studying? Is science reliable? What justifies science? These are questions having to do in general with the nature of science, not just its extent, but now its nature. And then thirdly, questions arise having to do with how do we put all that we have learned scientifically together in a coherent package. And so why would we have to worry about that? Well, because when we generalize, when we try to get laws that are general, that help us explain things in our experience, we run into problems. And not at this early stage of your education going to bother you with a lot of complicated examples. That's really what I'm very interested in, is the problems of philosophy that arise because we can't bring everything together. Let me just give you one example that I think would be very simple. We start generalizing, I said, about the way the world works. Let's take gravity. Okay? Children learn that as a general principle, things fall. Okay? There's a law of gravity. And they realize that this pertains to everything. It has nothing to do with your wishes. It has nothing to do with your desires. If I take this glass that's on the table here and fold it out over it, I can say, I want this to fall, and then let it go, and it will fall. But you know what? I can also say, I want it to stay right here in midair, and when I let it go, it's still going to fall. We realize that what happens out there in the physical world, to put it very simply, has very little to do with our desires. Now, of course, you can say, well, my desire to not have it fall leads me to hold on to it. In that sense, my desire affects the physical world. But you know very well that the character of falling has nothing to do with my desire for it to operate or not to operate. It's not like I can turn on the lights and not turn on the lights. Gravity is going to work whether I like it or not. So there's this impersonal, mechanistic nature of the physical world. But we know that not everything works that way. We know that Dad says, if you don't rake the leaves, you won't watch TV tonight. But sometimes you watch TV anyway, even though you didn't finish raking the leaves. Now, that may not be a good way to raise children, and I'm not trying to get down on fathers, get down on me. I'm not all that consistent, as I should be. But you know what I'm getting at? We realize there's an area of freedom in this world, too. and unpredictability. And that unpredictability is sometimes kind of frightening, you know? You go out on the playground and you've always played two square the way you've played it before, and lo and behold, you play it this way today and you beat somebody and he punches you in the nose. That never happened before. Okay, again, I'm being very simplistic, but you see, there's a problem. Now we see that the world can be explained mechanically, quote-unquote. Things happen whether we want them to or not. This cup's going to drop to the ground, regardless of my desires. And then we know there's an area that's not so predictable. There's an area that's characterized by freedom and choice and desire. Human choices in particular. Human character has to be taken into account in social relations and how we speak to people and what we do to them. Now then, how do we relate these two generalizations? That the world operates mechanically, the world operates on a principle of freedom. Part of the world, anyway, operates on this, you know, choice and desire and personality kind of thing where people make decisions. Part of the world doesn't. Well, how do you bring those two things together? So even if we did science as well as we possibly could, and we learned everything about astronomy and biology and sociology and history and how to make chocolate cakes and everything we could learn, we would still have questions about the extent of science, the nature of science, and how to reconcile or bring together into a coherent picture all the generalizations or laws that we have picked up on. Now, when we start asking those kinds of questions, and I hope you can see that I haven't mentioned the word yet, when we ask those kinds of questions, and everyone must ask those kinds of questions, even if just sloppily and implicitly going on with an assumed answer, when we ask those questions, we're no longer doing science. Now we're doing philosophy. Philosophy is the highest level of cognitive development, if you will. I don't say that with a sense of pride, but what I'm getting at is it is the highest level looking back upon previous levels. Curiosity, the level of the child, is haphazard. Science becomes more organized and looks for generalizations. But philosophy looks back upon science and asks about it, about its procedures and the character of what it's doing, and how it can reconcile the various things, the various conclusions that it comes up with. This leads me then to talk about the nature of a philosophical question. I think you all know what a medical question looks like. If we were to have a whole bunch of English questions on a sheet of paper, provided there were some that were medical there, you wouldn't have a hard time picking out the ones that are medical in nature. You know, like, how do you cure malaria? That's a medical question. How do you set a broken bone? That's a medical question. And you wouldn't have trouble, I think, identifying the historical questions. In what year did Columbus discover America? Or at least the islands? Who invented the steam engine? Things of that nature are historical questions. Okay, so you see what I'm getting at? You would know what sports or athletic questions look like, and on and on. How about this? What if I were to say, which of these questions is a philosophical question? You know, and probably given our background in comedy about philosophers, we'd look for the ones that are really dopey, you know, really, you know, nerdy questions that no one really cares about. Why is there air? You know, to go back to that. And real abstract and ridiculous things. We'd say, well, those are the philosophical questions. Well, I'm going to try to give you a little bit more helpful and accurate description of a philosophical question. What characterizes a philosophical question? I'll give you three things, I think. I probably should have said before we even began this lecture, reflecting on the nature of philosophy is, in a sense, a step beyond philosophy itself, isn't it? I mean, science reflects on curiosity, philosophy reflects on science, and what we're doing is reflecting on philosophy. And the funny thing about that is, you all are novices, as far as I know, in philosophy. You haven't done a lot of study. I have a PhD in it, so I'm supposed to be an expert. I say supposed to be an expert in philosophy. So as I introduce philosophy to you, obviously I'm taking for granted, or you need to know, you should take for granted. This is because I've stood back, having studied the field, and I said, oh, this is what's going on as I look at it, okay? So I'm giving you, at the end of, you know, my cognitive development on these things, looking back on what philosophy is, I'm sharing these results with you. It isn't as though you're going to go somewhere and look up in a book, you know. These are the characteristics of philosophy. You know, this is an ex post facto reflection. And what is it that marks philosophical problems? And I see some of you looking at me like, what is this all about? What I'm getting at is, if you want to know how to play baseball, you can go look it up in the rule book, right? You understand what a pitcher is and what a bat is and so forth and so on. I'm not laying out for you the rules of baseball. I'm not saying, okay, now these are the rules of philosophy. Everybody who studies philosophy knows these rules. And there's umpires, and they call you out and give you strikes and so forth. No, I'm saying I've studied philosophy, I've read people. In fact, what I'm giving you right now comes from, in many ways, a book by Halverson on Introduction to Philosophy. You look back at what philosophers are doing, and you can kind of get some general characteristics to help the beginning students. So that's what I'm doing with you. What are the three characteristics of a philosophical question? One, it is not straightforwardly answered by any special science. Or to put it ironically, it's a philosophical question because it's not a question in any other field that apart from the tongue in cheek, it's a question that doesn't fit in anywhere else. What we're getting at here is that you don't have a special science that resolves philosophical questions. There is a special science that resolves geographical questions or quantitative measuring questions or, economic questions, although I don't mean by that economics. There's problems with that. But you can go to the store and you can add up what all these groceries are going to, you know, cost. And if somebody says, what does oatmeal cost today at Kroger Market, there's a special, particular, delineated way to answer that question. Or somebody asked a question about, is there a cure for the common cold? We know that there's a special science that answers questions like that. We may not like the answer. The answer is no to that one. But the point is, we know who to ask. But when a philosophical question comes up, one of the things that makes it philosophical is we say, well, we don't know who to ask about this. And do I take this one to the butcher, or do I take it to the doctor, or to the lawyer, or to the astronomer, or to the historian? And the answer is no. Nobody has any particular special developed way to answer this question. Secondly, the question that is philosophical can be given persuasive but contrary answers. That is, there are alternative answers that have pros and cons for each of them. Philosophical question, it's not like it's so obvious that no one has to ask. You ask it and then you say, well, one school of thought will say this, and well, there's some good reason to believe what they're saying. But then another school of thought says something different and you say, but there's some good reason for that too. Aha, but you're saying, there are conflicts of opinion in other fields, said Dr. Bonson. Not all doctors agree on whether you should do surgery on this patient at this time. All right? And not all historians agree about Columbus or whatever it may be. So it can't be just that persuasive answers can be given, pro and con. That could be true of other schools of thought. The third point, the third characteristic of a philosophical question is that it's not immediately obvious how to resolve the conflict. it's not immediately obvious how to resolve the conflict. In other areas of thought, let's go back to our patient and the doctors arguing whether to operate. In that area of thought, it's not as though the doctors wouldn't be able to recognize a resolution if the information were available. It's because they don't have enough information that one set of doctors says operate now and the others interpret that limited information different than say no, don't operate now. But if they had more information, the doctors would know how to use the information and they would come to a conclusion. But that isn't the way it is with philosophy. It isn't as though, let's gather some more information, let's send students out on field trips and bring back their research, and then once we have enough data, we'll be able to resolve this philosophical problem. It doesn't work that way in philosophy. Okay? Now, I know this sounds frustrating. Some people have heard this and have said, well, then why would anybody want to go into this field? This sounds really frustrating to me. Now, there are some of us who either enjoy being frustrated or we think the frustration is worth the effort so we can understand the nature of human life and the meaning of life and the character of the world and so forth better. You have to do that, I think. And as a matter of fact, I'll be saying in a few minutes, everybody does do that. It's just not everybody does it well. So back to my point. The mark of a philosophical question is not straightforwardly answered by any special science. It has persuasive pros and cons available for alternative answers, and it's not immediately obvious how to resolve the conflict. So let me just do a little drill with you here. I'm going to throw out some questions, and I want you to tell me whether they are philosophical or not. I don't expect you to categorize it into anything beyond not philosophical. Okay, so it'd be real simple. It's either yes it is, no it's not. So we'll go around this way. If I ask, how far away is San Diego? Is that a philosophical question? No, that's not a philosophical. That's an easy one. Good. How about if I ask, should I travel faster than 65 miles an hour when I drive to San Diego? Is that a philosophical question? Yes, it is a philosophical question. And why is it? We might have thought that's just a question for the Department of Motor Vehicles. But actually, I'm asking, should I or am I under obligation to obey what the Department of Motor Vehicles tells me? How about this? What is the fine for speeding to San Diego? That's not a philosophical question. You can speak up.
No.
Good. It's not a philosophical question. Why not?
Because you could gather information from all the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Sure. I mean, it wouldn't be hard to get the answer to that question. And so it's not as though we're going to have alternative schools of thought with persuasive pros and cons and no one knows quite exactly how to resolve it. Okay, how about this? If I ask, but are the courts just in assessing that fine? Is that a philosophical question?
Yes.
Sure, because that assumes you know something about the nature of justice. And on that, there's no particular school, or a scientific method of determining that. Another one, who discovered San Diego? Is that philosophical?
No.
No, it's not. That's a historical question. And there may be disputes over it, but we know what a resolution would look like to the dispute if we had enough information. How about this? What motivated his exploration in finding San Diego? Is that philosophical?
Yeah.
No.
No,
no it's not. Let's think about that. Why is that not a philosophical question? It's tricky because it seems like, well, you could have, you know, real sloppy, ambiguous answers going different ways on that. But it's not really a question that couldn't be resolved if we had enough information. For instance, what if, it is Cortez, right? What if Cortez were still with us and we could, you know, interview him? And people could even compare his answers, you know, and ask whether he's being sincere and all that. That would be more a psychological question, it seems to me, not a philosophical question. How about this? In his choice to explore that region when he found San Diego, was he free in what he did? that a philosophical question?
I would say, yeah, it is a philosophical question.
And I think you're right. Tell me why.
Because it depends what you mean by free. It varies. You don't have any definition for truly free.
Well, you could get one. Somebody could give you an arbitrary definition. But the point is somebody could give an alternative definition, and you'd have schools of thought that would argue over that, and there's no obvious way to resolve that. Does a government exist in Mexico? Is that a philosophical question?
You could make it one if you didn't want to define government as a legislative body. But if you define it as a legislative body, then it has a government, because it's easy to go down there and find a legislative body.
Yeah, let's not get frustrated with the way Jay has answered this question. He's got a valuable insight. In a sense, you could make almost any question into a philosophical question. You could push real hard about the analysis of any word and so forth. But taking it in a more common sense way, if I ask, does a government exist in Mexico? Are we able to answer that?
Obviously there is.
Well, I'm not asking that the answer is yes or no. I think a person could say no because it's so shoddy that it doesn't come up to the standard of what we call government. But the point is, political science studies what government is and can tell you yes or no it has a government. How about this? Does anything like a government exist? So how's that different, Dr. Bonson? Now I'm asking about whether an immaterial thing like a government can be said to exist. The alternative would be, I mean, you might say, well, the answer is yes, because there's a legislative body in Mexico. But somebody might say, well, but all you're saying when you speak of government is you're talking about there are individuals doing particular things, performing certain actions, and that's what you're generalizing as government. But if you mean government in something beyond the particulars of the physical world, no, there's no such thing as a government. That's similar to the question, where is the university? Now, we have that would be funny applied to Christ College for various reasons. But let's just take a more obvious illustration. Let's take the University of Virginia. Somebody said, where is the university? That could be taken as a geographical question. It's like, well, it's right here on the map. Take this highway and make a left and so forth. But let's say we got there and somebody said, well, where's the university? I said, well, look, I mean, it's here, all these buildings. The person could say, no, the buildings don't make a university. You got buildings over there, too. They don't. There's got to be something more to the university than buildings. You say, oh, okay, well, yeah, there's got a student body. See, they're all walking around at lunchtime here. Some are going over there buying books and some are eating in the cafeteria and so forth. So yeah, there's the university, the student body. No. I mean, you could have other people than these be here and you would still have the university. Well, that's true. Okay, so then where's the university? Oh, you must mean the administration building, you know, where all the records are kept and people are admitted and so forth. Well, so the university offices are right over there. No, I'm not talking about the offices of the university. I'm talking about the university. Well, the university is a place where people are educated. So you must mean the classrooms. Not in the building sense. We've already dismissed that. So we go into the classroom and say, there's the university. There's a professor. There's students. There's the university. Well, but this can't be the university. This is just one class of the university. Now, when I ask the question, does anything like an immaterial entity, a government, exist? That's similar to saying, is there something, the university, that goes beyond all the particular manifestations that we associate with universities? Is that a philosophical question? Because I've given myself away, haven't I? Obviously, that's a philosophical question. Because some people would say, well, that's just ridiculous. You don't have to answer that kind of question. Some people would say it's answered in this way. These functions of the university. Somebody else might say, no, there is a general concept that we all have in our minds that makes the university what it is. So, a philosophical question, just to belabor our point, is not straightforwardly answered by any special science. It has persuasive pros and cons available for alternative answers, that question or questions, and it's not immediately obvious how to resolve the conflict here. Okay, if we were to look at the sorts of questions that arise in philosophy, could we give a general answer as to the basic concern in all of them? I think we can, and I know that different philosophers would probably, you know, do it a little bit differently. But this is my way of putting it. If you look at the philosophical questions that are asked throughout the history of Western thought, in one way or another, I think, they all come down to being concerned with, I know it's going to be highly abstract, highly general, but I think in one way or another, all of those things that count as philosophical questions are concerned with the presuppositions and conceptual muddles that we find in any field of thought or area of human concern. In the most general sense, philosophical questions are concerned with the presuppositions and the conceptual muddles that we find in any field of thought or area of human concern. Medical science has developed ways of prolonging life. Philosophers are not concerned with the techniques of dealing with comatose patients or saving people that have particular diseases and so forth. But philosophers are concerned with the presuppositions that are utilized by scientists, like the presupposition that what we've learned in the laboratory 5 years ago is applicable today, that the world is not such a chaotic place, that there's no predictability. That's a presupposition. Doctors don't prove that, they just operate on that assumption, pardon the pun. Operate on that assumption. Philosophers deal with those presuppositions. But then conceptual muddles come up. You know, if nature is uniform and predictable and man is part of nature, obviously his body is, that's why medical doctors can operate on him, then are all human choices predictable as well? That is, because there's no freedom, everything works mechanically. Man may be very complex, but when all said and done, he's not really free. And yet we treat him as though he's free. So now we've got a conceptual muddle. On the one hand, we think man is not free. That's why doctors can operate on his body. There's predictability. And yet we treat man as though he is free. That's why we hold him accountable in a court of law for what he does. But then some people would say, well, we really shouldn't hold him accountable. He couldn't help it. He's just, you know, a complex, you know, organism subject to conditioning and response. So the philosopher says, how do we deal with that conceptual muddle? Is man free or not free? And it can come up in any field of thought or area of human concern. I happen to pick up on medical science, but questions come up in how should we govern? Who should we vote for president? What should we think of death? All sorts of areas of thought are ripe for developing philosophical questions. But the philosopher deals not with the specific subject matter of biology or astronomy, sociology, medicine, whatever it may be. The philosopher deals with the presuppositions of all these fields of thought. What are the underlying assumptions about the nature of reality, how we know what we know, and how we should live our lives? Philosophers deal with the presuppositions and conceptual muddles that arise in any field or field of thought or area of human concern. Well, what are philosophers trying to do? Let's go thirdly then to the task of philosophy. Again, as we look back at the history of what's been called philosophy, I do think it's possible to generalize as to what philosophers were doing. A lot of people would say philosophers have basically wasted our time in a very cynical attitude, and that, of course, doesn't answer the question, what were they doing as they were wasting our time? So even if you are down on philosophy, you still have to ask, what were they trying to do? And I think the answer to our question, whether you have a positive or negative attitude starting